Welcome to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal. I'm Amy Brown, here with co-host Meredith DeFrancesco. Today we'll be speaking with Peter Garrett of Midnight Oil.
But first this. The third annual Living Wage Rally, sponsored by, among others, the Maine Rural Workers Coalition, will be this Friday, May 3rd, from noon to 2 p.m. at the Capitol Building in Augusta. Among others attending will be candidates for governor and Congress. Speakers will talk about their experiences working jobs that don't adequately support them. Tonight, the Peninsula Peace and Justice Center will present the film People and the Land about the Palestinian conflict, followed by a talk by Professor Jane Addis at the Blue Hill Public Library at 7 p.m. Now, last Thursday's interview with Peter Garrett from Midnight Oil. Midnight Oil's music has been acclaimed for its artistry, but also for its political content. Their songs continue to inform and activate on a number of issues facing the world and the country they come from, Australia. Over the past two-plus decades, their music has addressed Aboriginal rights, labor and environmental problems, the crisis in East Timor, and U.S. military action, to name a few. But it has not only been through their music, but how and when they perform, and what they do when they're offstage. In 1990, they protested the Exxon Valdez oil spill by performing on a flatbed trailer in front of Exxon's Manhattan corporate headquarters. At the 2000 Sydney Olympics, they drew attention to the treatment of Australia's Aboriginal people by performing their popularized songs, Beds Are Burning, in front of the unsuspecting Prime Minister of Australia. They performed at the blockade of uranium mining in Jabiluka within the Australia's Kadu National Park. Peter Garrett, Midnight Oil's lead singer and one of the lyrics writers, has been very active off the stage. In 1980, he ran for the Australia Senate on a nuclear disarmament ticket, losing by a small margin. From 1989 to 1993, and now again from 1998 to present, Garrett is active as the president of the environmental organization, the Australian Conservation Foundation. The group has successfully gained protections for a number of threatened areas in Australia. The group has recently been working on issues with the National Farmers Federation. Garrett has also been vocal on the powers of the WTO, World Trade Organization, Australia's extensive uranium mining, human rights in East Timor, genetically modified foods, and nuclear power. He is additionally involved with a number of cultural and community groups, including the Australian Human Rights Foundation and Jubilee 2000. We have with us today Peter Garrett, again the lead singer and one of the lyric writers for Midnight Oil. Midnight Oil performed Thursday 25th at the Maine Center for the Arts, a benefit concert for WERU Community Radio. Welcome, Peter.
Welcome, and thank you.
Thanks very much.
Great. I guess we're going to start off with a look at Aboriginal rights. In this state, we have recently been witness to how Indigenous people are legally intimidated in becoming outspoken on environmental issues that directly affect them. In Maine's case, a group of paper companies with the state support used a water pollution issue to challenge tribal sovereignty in court. Can you give us an idea of what it's like for Aboriginal people in Australia and what issues they are dealing with?
The brief history of Indigenous people in Australia is one of dispossession running from east to west across the continent when the British first arrived. In the early 1700s, and Aboriginal people have been effectively displaced from most of the towns and cities that the majority of Australians live in. Where they haven't been dispossessed, which is in the centre and the north of the country, as it turns out now, there are areas of significant mineral wealth and also natural and cultural significance. For a number of years, the Australian legal system denied Aboriginal people the legitimacy to make a claim for land that had been previously theirs on the basis of the doctrine known as terra nullius, which said that the continent was an empty space or an empty place when the English first arrived. That doctrine was overturned by our High Court in 1997, and subsequent to that, a number of High Court decisions have significantly improved both the potential for Aboriginal people to claim back their land, and once they do claim it back, for them to have some say over how they may or may not use it. But up until this period of time, Aboriginal people have been marginalised, removed, and in those instances where they still are able to inhabit their own tribal or ancestral lands, under considerable pressure to allow exploitation from mining companies.
And what kind of mining are you referring to here?
It's mainly uranium mining, although in Australia, as your introduction about what the Oars and myself have done kind of hinted at, we've really been fighting uranium mining in Australia for about 30 years. And we've succeeded in, of the some 115 or so mines or mine sites that were due to be explored or exploited, we've succeeded in only seeing about five mines go through in that 30-year period of time. That's been a combination of grassroots actions, one of the major political parties being prepared to limit mine policy, legal challenges, and the depressed state of the uranium mining market itself, but as well as uranium mining, gold, zinc, and alumina are some of the other minerals that have been on Aboriginal land.
Would you like to make some sort of comment or leave this for another time on the formal apology that you were trying to get the Government of Australia to issue? Is that still a current issue that you would like to refer to or not?
In Australia, one of the major features of the campaign for Aboriginal people to both get their land back and also, in a sense, take some direct control over their own affairs has been a call on behalf of many groups and citizens that there should be a formal apology issued by the federal government for the original treatment and dispossession of Aboriginal people. We've had a couple of royal commissions and commissions of inquiry which have looked at that issue and have all recommended that a formal apology would be appropriate thing for a national government to do. As it's turned out, in the period of time when this debate has been raging, we've had a quasi-Republican government in Australia, a very conservative government, who've chosen, for a number of reasons, most of them probably spurious, not to want to issue that formal apology. Even though state governments, churches, and other institutions have in fact issued apologies. And this became one of those, if you like, sort of defining tests for the morality of what in our country is the Conservative administration, which they failed comprehensively, even though the public opinion polls continue to increase in number in terms of the numbers of people who are willing to support the idea of an apology. We all teach our kids to say sorry if they do something wrong, but our Prime Minister just hasn't quite got the message.
And we will take a break right now to hear Dead Heart by Midnight Oil.
In this area, we've seen a lot of real direct impacts of globalization, free trade policies. We've had a lot of layoffs, thousands of jobs lost, a few thousand jobs lost in Central Maine area just in the past several months, and directly traceable to their jobs being sent overseas where they can hire people for, you know, much cheaper rates and with absolutely no human rights watch or any of the environmental regulations that we have here. And I know you've spoken out about accountability for the WTO, thinking of World Bank policies, free trade agreements, all that corporate globalization stuff that's all tied in together. What have the impacts been in your country that you've been seeing?
I don't think the impact of globalization has been as pronounced in Australia as it has, for example, in North America, the United States, or other parts of the world, for a couple of reasons. The first is that, in effect, Australia did become a global trading entity about 10 years ago when we deregulated our financial system. And the effect of that was to place numbers of people out of work very quickly. But it has to also be said that it did make those industries with which we were seeking to export to other parts of the world efficiently, more efficient. And I think that there's a very interesting issue ultimately about globalization. My own view, even though I've spoken out quite strongly about the way in which globalization has been introduced, my own view is that there's an inevitability in globalization. And I think the challenge for people who want to see a fairness and equity, a protection of the environment, human rights and labour standards, is to ensure that the institutions of globalisation reflect those standards. Otherwise, we end up in a really difficult philosophical position, which is where we talk very eloquently about a global world on the one hand, but we're not prepared to actually embrace or mediate that global world on another hand. The great danger, of course, is that in attempting to mediate globalization, we find that we're not dealing with accountable institutions. If we were dealing with sovereign national governments, it would probably be a tough struggle, but a struggle which ultimately citizenry could win. The difficulty is that we're actually dealing with companies, limited by law and guarantee, quite often capable of moving their resources across borders, and frankly, without any sense of public policy or civic policy or accountability at all other than to their shareholders. It seems to me that's the biggest challenge of all, is bringing the companies to bear as opposed to the resistance of globalisation. By the same token, I think that those people that have been involved in protest, who've been out on the streets, particularly when they've been demonstrating peacefully and articulately, have done a great deal to open up the debate. And in Australia, I have supported the activities of those people, but whilst at the same time saying to them that I think that we are going to see some form of globalising take place, let's make sure it's as good as we can get.
And what would that look like? Public participation in the decision making, or revoking personhood? Or
it would mean a number of things, I think, and perhaps for the purpose of this interview, I'll run through them pretty briefly in my own views. The first is levels of public participation and transparency through the existing international instruments that regulate trade. The second would be to ensure that the international system of sovereign governments becomes the point at the top of the apex for determining and enacting in their own legislation and ensuring that complementary legislation is enacted in other jurisdictions, those same standards. The third is to require within the domestic jurisdictions, particularly within Western Europe, the United States, and some of the smaller OECD countries and countries like wealthy countries of the Commonwealth like Canada and Australia and New Zealand, that companies simply do not have the capacity to run away from their broader obligations. An integration through international instruments, national legislation, citizen participation, transparency, and complementary and consistent legislation ought to mean, at the very least, that we'll know who's doing wrong and who's doing right, and we can shine the light on the wrongdoers and praise the good doers.
Thanks.
All right. The environment has been a consistent front burner issue for you.
Yeah.
And can you give us an idea of some of the main environmental issues in Australia and ones that you've been working personally on? And also if you could comment on the concept of the precautionary principle.
Well, I think the issues in Australia have been very similar to the US. You know, we started off in the 50s and the 60s, coming into the 70s, really working on forest issues. Out of the forest issues, we've gone into seeking to preserve those other parts of the terrestrial estate which are significantly at threat, which would be grasslands, wetlands, desert areas, you know, whatever's left effectively outside the forests. Additional to that, in our own country, we've got two or three significant issues. The first one that probably differs from here is Australia's got a very thin soil profile. Unlike Europe and the US, where you've got sort of 10 feet or so of these wonderful river valleys and lots of topsoil, we've got about 1.5 to 2 inches of topsoil. So we have tremendous problems now with saltification of farmland and of the landscape that's come about firstly by knocking over all the original eucalypt trees, which were the natural and native tree cover of the country, and secondly by significant amounts of irrigation, which has meant that salt has been drawn up from the subsurface to the surface of the soil, and that then spreads as a disease across the country. And it's a really significant problem for Australia, much the same as we've seen in parts of the Middle East. Now, the final issues would be issues to do with our coastal marine environment. Australia's got the largest littoral jurisdiction and certainly highest benthamic biodiversity, that's like fish and native seagrasses and all those sorts of things, of any country in the world. We're only a population of some 19 million. Included in that are places like the Great Barrier Reef, one of the natural wonders of the world. And the proper protection, adequate protection of our sea environment has become one of the leading issues for us. Additional to that, I just simply have to make the final point that, of course, like other countries, we're wrestling with the prospects of global warming and climate change. And Australia has been it's been the only developed country to follow the very poor position that the US have had in not wanting to go with the Kyoto protocols and follow climate change reductions and go for this sort of, you know, half-baked, half-assed, voluntary, you know, companies will tell us how they're not going to do it sort of thing that President Bush, etc., has gone on with. When it comes to the precautionary principle, I don't think that in Australia it's fully understood by the public. At the bureaucratic business, government and citizen groups levels, it's much better understood because we went through a process with our last equivalent democratic administration where we were able to introduce the idea of ecologically sustainable development as being one of the indices for the various departments of government to take on board. Now, it has to be said that they didn't take it on board all that seriously, but it was introduced to them as a concept. And to be frank, it's one of the things that's always driven me very hard is this idea that I grew up as someone very fortunate with a better standard of living than anyone in the French royal family or the English royal family could ever have had. I'm educated, I'm male, I'm healthy. And yet at the same time, you know, I'm charging around this place doing whatever I'm doing. But have I really thought about what the effect of that, the impact of that is likely to be on anyone else, particularly my successors and inheritors? Which is effectively, I think, partially what the precautionary principle is about. So to introduce the precautionary principle into decision-making and policy-making is easy, but to introduce it into business practice and commerce is hard. And to me, that's become the major intellectual task that we have now faced. And at the ACF, it's the one that I've been particularly interested in us pushing through. I don't mind being in a tree. I don't mind being up on a ledge. I don't mind being on a blockade. I think there's an urgent moral necessity for us to confront destructive actions, to be activists. But at the same time, I don't want to be doing it when I'm 65, you know. I'd really like us to be thinking through some of these issues in a constructive fashion and utilising human intelligence to work out better ways of living in balance on the earth. And certainly the challenge there is not government, the challenge is business, and the challenge is to bring business into a way of thinking which is much more sustainable than there is now. And we've started tentatively to do that. I hear noise.
Speaking of government and balance, what are you hearing from folks in Australia about our open-ended so-called war on terrorism?
Well, I think that at a government level, we've got a good deal of enthusiasm and support for President Bush's position, whatever he does.
And if he's the president.
Yeah. And if he's the president, indeed. Amongst the public, I think there's also a fair amount of support for Americans. I mean, it may come as a surprise to the American left to find that the Australian left actually thinks that terrorists should be, you know, they'll go with the idea of knocking out the terrorists, and they won't sort of worry so much about the fact that it's a right-wing government that's using that as a cover to do many other things. We don't know in Australia, for example, that President Bush tried to make an argument towards the end of last year that if you didn't approve the drilling for oil in the Alaskan wilderness, that you were akin to a supporter of a terrorist. And it was a terrible argument, and he was rebuked by many people for it, as he should have been. But we don't get that sort of level of detail in Australia. So I think in Australia people are concerned about terrorism. It's been such a peaceful country, and they're quite horrified at what they saw on TV, and that's really all they saw. And sorry about what happened to the people, but not particularly mindful of the foreign policy implications or the way in which, you know, the actual case has been prosecuted.
Hmm. Yeah. I guess just to touch on that, because we are sort of drawing closer to the end, on any other issues of great prominence that you're working on, I don't know if you would like to talk about the issue of nuclear power and those sorts of things that you've been working on, including the opportunities for solar power we've read you comment on, or any other issues that you would particularly like to bring up.
Oh, look, there are many issues to talk about, aren't there? And I've really enjoyed the opportunity to yarn to people on the radio. But look, one of the arguments that I've been putting, and I'm not alone, many other people have said it, but I've been talking about the 21st century bit to be a solar century. It seems to me that the technology is pretty much there now for us, particularly in places like Australia, to harness the free power of the sun in order to reduce the reliance that we have on fossil fuel and have an energy mix, but basically a soft and renewable energy mix. And we'll continue to argue those arguments and fight those fights and oppose nuclear power and the nuclear power industry in its many forms in Australia. It's a sort of defining litmus issue for us there. It's not as advanced as it is here. But I think, I guess, finally, more importantly, I think, is the idea that we can fight different issues in a discrete fashion. But in some ways that's not sufficient for us, because we can't, I don't think, as in people are concerned about the environment, think only of it as the fact that I'm concerned about the environment, someone is not concerned about it, therefore we're enemies, therefore we oppose them. It's much more to do with the way in which we change our way of thinking and change our heart posture. And I see that as being one of the great challenges in the work that I'm doing, is to encourage people who don't think the way that we do, who don't believe the things that we do, come away from their own positions a little bit, and maybe us come away from ours a bit, to try and find some meeting and some common ground. Now, to strong hardline activists, that quite often sounds like, oh, well, we're starting to go a little bit weak on the opposition. But it's actually something quite different from that. It's a recognition that just as we talk about sharing ecology, we also share humanity. And we have to find ways of getting to people, particularly early on in their lives, and making them appreciate the idea of equity amongst humans and equity amongst animals and living things. And when people take that as a principle with them, then whatever they do, we're likely to have a slightly better existence for ourselves.
That kind of leads into the last question we had, which is, I read something that you said in a speech that really rang true with something that we've discussed a lot, which is, we try to include a song that has something political in every one of our shows, even though the show is mostly informational, because we really believe that there's something about poetry or music that touches in some other part of the psyche that just hard facts just don't get
yes.
to. And so we were talking about this last night and just wondering how much, like, Beds Are Burning is almost like an anthem in a good way, in a good sense of anthem, and how much the song is written and the other songs are written to intentionally kind of mobilize people, or if they unintentionally do that when you're just expressing how you feel.
Yeah, look, it's a good question, and it's the latter. The songs are not written intentionally to mobilize anybody. They're written for ourselves as musicians to perform and to express something that we feel strongly about. And quite often it's common for folk to look at Midnight Oil from the outside and to see this sort of fairly coherent musical sort of agit, sort of politic sort of unit sort of bumping around the planet here and there. But in actual fact, the reality is quite different. We don't think that music can change the world. But we think that people can change the world. But they need music as their partner, as an inspirer, sometimes as a pacifier, as a soulmate, to travel with them in that journey. And some of our songs have been able to do that, and some of our songs have been about things that are quite specific, but they've always arrived as songs from the predominant creative act of putting bits of music together and words and then letting them out there into the world to see what happens to them.
Great. Well, you've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal. I'm Amy Brown.
And I'm Meredith DeFrancesco.
We'd like to thank Helen York for engineering today, Tim Knowlton for technical assistance, Andy Buckley for web support, and you for listening and acting, and of course, Peter Garrett of Midnight Oil for being our guest. You can contact us at WERU or by emailing radioactivenews@hotmail.com. You can listen to archived Radioactive programs on the web at www.freespeech.org/RAN or at mainindymedia.org. You can contact us here at the station or by emailing us at radioactivenews@hotmail.com. Stay tuned now for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Democracy Now!
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Tone Poem off Midnight Oil's new album, Capricornia.
If you are interested in reading about Peter Garrett or reading some of his many speeches, you can catch him online. He has his own website. Here's the web address, www.petergarrett.com.au. That's www.petergarrett.com.au.
Only bleak green fields are burning, reefs on fire, and bellies are swollen, they're hurting. Oh, we're in victims, I don't think so. We won't be pinned against the wall. No slogan that can feed you. Where will you live when the fields are falling? Where will you live when the feedlot's calling? Everybody standing in a treetop saying, where will you live? Where will you live? Tearing up your ticket for the new Titanic. He is refugee. No.
world.